Thank you. Thank you for having me, and you can never be too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Linda Ambrose Broneman, author of The Pulitzer Saga, a book documenting the recovery of 8 generations of unknown Jewish family history. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. American election season ended last week, and in spite of the predictions of a close vote with the presidential decision coming down to few states or even counties, it wasn't that close at all. In fact, we had an orderly, more or less sane election after a pretty ugly campaign season. Are there any other kinds these days? And that was somewhat reassuring. There was no violence, no fake voters, no effective disinformation campaigns, and no one is currently claiming there was fraud. I don't expect the incumbent president in the White House to lead an insurrection to try to overturn the results of a Democratic election. And whether you are pleased or depressed by the results, the simple fact that we can have a reasonable transition of power, that grown-ups are in office and will act with the maturity and sanity we expect from our leaders in the world's most important democracy, is gratifying. That's how it is supposed to work. Like many Americans, I have concerns about the incoming Trump administration in many areas. I do not, however, have any doubts that a second Trumpian presidency will be supportive of Israel. And I do have confidence that it will work against the anti-Semitic climate that has developed in parts of America over the past 13 months, particularly ever since the October 7th Palestinian terrorist atrocities in 2023. As long as we are doing hindsight on the campaign, perhaps Kamala Harris should have chosen Josh Shapiro, the Jewish governor of Pennsylvania, as her running mate after all. Maybe she would have had more electoral success. We will never know. As always, this is an interesting time in America. May it prove to be a positive one. And in particular, may our strong democratic institutions always prevail. We will need them to, as we always do. And we will need honesty. That has sometimes been hard to come by in recent days. I have been thinking particularly about truth lately, one of the foundational concepts of Judaism. The truth is always bent a great deal during election seasons, but in Judaism, God's very essence is truth. Adonai Eloheichem Emet, we say at the conclusion of the Shema, central statement of monotheism, God is the God of truth. As President Abraham Lincoln said, I am a firm believer in the people. If given the truth, they can be depended upon to meet any national crisis. The great point is to bring them the real facts. In our world of intentionally disinformative social media, of alternate facts and siloed press and well-funded deliberate efforts to convince people of false narratives and just plain lies, we are going to need to make certain that what we are being told is true, and we will need to speak for the truth and work to advance the truth and insist on the truth, whether we like what we hear or don't. George Washington said, "The truth will ultimately prevail where there are pains to bring it to light." That's not just an American mission. It is the central Jewish mission. May we all work to make it so. Play us in this morning on the subject of truth. Here's part of a setting of Emet ve'emunah, kol zot, true and certain it is, you are God. Or maybe you are God because you are true and certain. As sung by Chazan Alberto Mizrahi with a remarkable choir, this is part of a composition by Joshua Lind. That was Emet V'Emunah, True and Certain. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Linda Ambrose Brenneman, author of The Pulitzer Saga, a book that documents the recovery of eight generations of her own unknown Jewish family history. Hear the fascinating story about how it came about when we return in just a moment on Two Jewish. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Linda Ambrose Brenneman is the author of an extraordinary new nonfiction book called The Pulitzer Saga, which comes out of, well, I think one of the most remarkable origin stories of any book of remembrance that I can ever recall. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning, Rabbi Cohn. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
So, tell us about the house fire and how all of this family history suddenly exploded on you.
I grew up in Buffalo, New York, and I thought I was the American-born daughter of Hungarian Catholic parents. I did find out when I was 27 years old that my father was Jewish, but never did anything about it and never learned anything more. And there was this incredible web of secrecy in my family. It was that was difficult to penetrate. So any questions were deflected or, you know, we don't talk about that here. So I never knew anything about my family origins, my father's family in particular. And as you said, in 2011, my parents' house caught fire. And unfortunately, my mother died as a result of the fire. But my sister was trying to save everything. You know, after the firemen put out the fire, there was a lot of water damage. So she was trying to pull out whatever she could to make sure it was safe. Didn't even realize that she had pulled out a box. I think it was in my mother's office. So years later, I had decided it was time for me to look into my family story, to really investigate my father's Jewish family. And just at that time, she was cleaning out a closet and found the box and sent it to me. And that was the start of the journey. Its contents were unbelievable. You know, photographs, pictures, documents, letters. And of course, they were all in Hungarian, so I couldn't understand them at first, but found someone to help translate and investigate my family's Jewish history.
So these documents, now, you know, normally we think of a box of letters, they'll be one or two generations. That's not what this is. Tell us just how far back it goes and the origins of this whole collection.
Well, what was interesting, that the key in the box was a family tree book. And originally I thought that my father's cousin, who was autistic and remembered everything, had written it. But I think, I've come to think that it was my grandmother. And in it were names that I had never heard, but they went back generations and generations. But I still didn't know anything about them. And so what happened was, as I was looking for someone to help me translate and understand what was there, I found a friend of a friend who was Hungarian. And she was a remarkable woman. And I sat down with her and went through just one of the folders that had been in the box filled with letters. And when she saw them, she was stunned and said, many of these letters and documents really belong in a museum. But most importantly, she said, you need to have somebody to help you research and understand them. And she put me in touch with András Gazicki, who was a Hungarian lawyer and sociologist, and I will just say, a brilliant sleuth and a remarkable person. He really became a very trusted friend and advisor to me on this journey that we went on, basically for 8 years. And he found just remarkable things, including two books that had been written by my relatives, and one of those was entitled Our Family History, written by Zygmunt Pulitzer, who lived in the late 1800s. He died in 1920. And he was my great-great-great uncle, and he had researched the family. And so that's how we had stories that went back 8 generations of Pulitzers.
We will talk much more with Linda Ambrose Brenneman about the Pulitzer saga, which is truly a saga, when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills and northwest Tucson, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this fall and winter. Established 6 years ago by congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary in person. Call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Religious schools available for school-age children and grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Hebrew school, Bar and Bat Mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes Experience, Confirmation, and Teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Our services, classes, and events are open to everyone. In person Friday night, Shabbat services are at 6:30 p.m., always followed by a delicious Onig Shabbat. Saturday morning, 9 a.m. Torah study is followed at 10 a.m. by Shabbat morning services and Kiddush, all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. You can also come on Facebook for our services. That's Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimchaTucson on our Facebook page. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. Access those by emailing us, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, or just go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school, Torah Tikes program, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person or on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest growing and most dynamic Jewish congregation in all of southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's twojewishradio18@gmail. Or go to our website, twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, twojewishradio.com, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 200,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify, too. Post a rating. Review Too Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about a trip that you just came back from, in which you visited a variety of fascinating places, as always, but a Jewish heritage trip that you led that, and the country of Georgia, fascinating stuff, interesting Jewish community, and a significant one still.
That was our last stop, and I was there less than a week ago. So a couple things to report. Sort of. Most people don't even know where Georgia is. So it's just to the northeast of Turkey. It's one of the three countries that make up the Caucasus, the other two being Armenia and Azerbaijan. And Azerbaijan famously is majority Muslim, overwhelming majority. Armenia and Georgia are not only Christian, but they each have their own national autocephalous church. So they don't report to the Pope in Rome or to the Catholicos in Istanbul. The three countries share a lot culturally, even though they have different religions and different histories. One of the big things is the national sport in all three countries is toast making. So little boys stand in front of mirrors all day long when they're 3-4 years old, practicing making toasts, because at a Georgian or Armenian or Azerbaijani social event, getting together and making countless toasts and tossing back the whole thing at once, it's like an obligation. It's time consuming, it's fun, but I mean, it's interesting to me that the three countries are so different yet have so much in common. And particularly today, Georgia is a place full of tensions. One tension is that two theoretically breakaway regions, which have significant Russian-speaking minorities, are essentially occupied by Russia, South Ossetia and Abkhazia. And there are other areas that Russia is panting to take over. And Russia did invade Georgia in 2008, and they restored order in what they saw as a menacing disorder to the former Soviet space, over which they feel some kind of protective obligation. The Georgians don't necessarily see it that way. And what was interesting for me, as opposed to my first visit there, which was more than 50 years ago, today in Georgia, only people over 40 or 50 are comfortable speaking Russian. Younger people want to speak English or Georgian, and they're overwhelmingly oriented towards the West. I mean, they want a closer relationship with Brussels and all the institutions that are based there, be it NATO or the European Union or whatever else is based in Brussels. They do not want a closer relationship with Moscow, but they have been saddled for the past 12 or 16 years with a party controlling the parliament that is specifically pro-Russian and wants a closer alliance with Moscow. Hard to imagine closer than it is now. But the president of Georgia is a woman who's very pro-Western and who looked at the surveys and the polls and said, we're going to win this election by 56 to 44 or 54 to 46 or whatever. And that is what the polls show. But the party in power, which controls the parliament and all the machinery of voting, rigged the elections, essentially. So they won won, and the country will go up in flames, and probably Russia will use it as an excuse to invade once again. So Georgia is kind of at a crossroads politically, culturally, economically. It's very capitalistic. It has a clear market economy. You can get everything there, but most people can't afford anything.
Right.
In the old days, there was nothing in the shops, so people could afford everything there was because
there was nothing to buy.
Right.
Yeah.
So things have changed. The one thing that hasn't changed is the metro, which, like in Moscow and Leningrad or St. Petersburg and Kyiv, the metros are very, very deep. They're like 1,500 meters underground. The escalators are steep and extremely rapid and scary if you're not used to them. And they haven't bought any new cars since this metro was opened in 1972.
Oh my God.
So everything there is at least 50 years old.
That's shaky and scary, I would expect, but colorful.
Yes, very.
Tom, thanks so much. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew. Brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Jesus is standing in for St. Peter at the pearly gates when an old man shuffles up. Jesus goes through the standard entry procedure. Name, says Jesus. Joseph, says the old man. Occupation, asks Jesus. Carpenter, replies the old man. Family, any children? Continues Jesus. I once had a son, answers the man. Jesus is getting kind of nervous now. Describe him, he says. Well, said the old man, he was a little strange and childlike, and he had nails in his hands and feet. Jesus peers closely at the old man and says, Father? And the old man embraces Jesus eagerly and shouts with joy, Pinocchio! Okay, so I'm not really sure that's a Jewish joke, but it's certainly an old joke. Still, the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Vayera, which includes the great and terrible story of the binding of Isaac, the Akedah, in which God tests Abraham by having him almost, but not quite, sacrifice his only beloved son Isaac on a rock. Famous for being read on Rosh Hashanah, its connection seems to be the fact that a ram appears at the end of the story, caught in a thicket by its horns, the model for all future shofars. But this passage, taken from the portion of Vayera, is much more than a mere animal story. Cryptic yet oddly repetitive, it raises a host of painful moral dilemmas, challenging us to think intensely about just what our relationship to God truly is.
Oh, God said to Abraham, kill me a son. Abe said, man, you must be putting me on. God said, no. Abe said, what? God said, you can do what you want, Abe, but next time you see me coming, you better run. Well, Abe said, where do you want this killing done? God said, all on Highway 61.
In Vayera, God tests Abraham. Adonai Nisa et Avraham, it says, commanding him to sacrifice his son, his only son, his beloved son Isaac. This triple identification of Isaac mirrors an earlier command in the Torah portion of Lech Lecha last week, that Abraham must begin his great journey towards God and monotheism. Leave, it says there, leave your land, leave your birthplace, leave your father's home. Now he is being told to kill his son, his only son, his beloved son. Well, there are problems in the text. Abraham has another older son, Ishmael. Isaac is not truly his only son. Isaac is actually the son of his old age with his wife Sarah, and Isaac is therefore Sarah's only son. Clearly, all God has to say is, take your son Isaac, and there'll be no doubt who is intended for the altar. Why all the extra language around this sacrifice? It's a messy passage. But the biggest challenge of all is the simple fact that Abraham, who has previously shown a tendency to argue and fight injustice, obeys this terrible divine command and does so with apparent relish. He doesn't make a peep, doesn't say a single word of objection to God. In fact, we're told he gets up especially early in the morning in order to fulfill this horrible command of God energetically. The narrative itself sets up the drama beautifully, painfully, tragically. Isaac, who doesn't know what's being established, goes along with his father. The phrase, the two walked on together, Vayechu Shnehem Yachdav, is repeated. Isaac asks, where is the lamb for the burnt offering? And Abraham replies, correctly but ironically, God will provide. It's a troubling scene. And then, as Abraham's about to slaughter his son, an angel of God intervenes. And the murder, well, at least the sacrificial killing, if you will, of the innocent, this sacrifice of Isaac, is stopped. Isaac lives, and the future of our people, Abraham's children, is preserved. The story in its place and time was undoubtedly a polemical tale designed in a harsh way to teach the prohibition on human sacrifice. Children are not meant to be slaughtered on the altar of their parents' beliefs. God does not want the blood of a human lamb. Our Lord does not truly desire the destruction of his own children. God desires life. Other religions have taken this Akedah story to a different, bloodier, more horrible conclusion, believing human sacrifice and suffering are the essential elements in a religious life. But the story of the binding of Isaac makes it clear that killing our own children, the glorification of the loss of a child, will never be acceptable to Jews. In fact, Abraham's urgent rush to fulfill God's terrible command to kill his son reminds us we have the unfortunate ability to embrace morally bad decisions with great fervor. Many times in human history, we have sent our children off to die for causes that were not ethical. The great World War I poet Wilfred Owen, who died in that war, paraphrased this theme in a piece he wrote called The Parable of the Old Man and the Young. So Abram rose and clave the wood and went and took the fire with him and a knife. And as they journeyed, both of them together, Isaac the firstborn spake and said, My father, behold the preparations, fire and iron, but where the lamb for this burnt offering? Then Abram bound the youth with belts and straps and builded parapets and trenches there and stretched forth the knife to slay his son. When lo, an angel called him out of heaven, saying, Lay not thy hand upon the lad, neither do anything to him thy son. Behold, caught in a thicket by its horns a ram. Offer the ram of pride instead. But the old man would not do so, but slew his son, and half the seed of Europe, one by one. You know, Wilfred Owen wrote of the ways in which his elders sent his own generation off to die in World War I a century ago. But we still engage in such choices. Like Abraham, we still often fail the test. May we learn from the Torah, from this Akedah story and test of Abraham's, to choose life, not sacrifice, for our own children. When we come back in a moment, our guest, Linda Ambrose Brenneman, will explain how she discovered a deep and rich Jewish family history she had no idea existed, and how it became a fascinating new book, The Pulitzer Saga, shining a light on a remarkable history. Hear all about it when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
While the U.S. was electing Donald Trump to a new term as president after a four-year reprieve, Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu chose that busy and distracting time to fire Yoav Gallant, Israel's Minister of Defense, in the midst of a multi-front war. Netanyahu has had tension with Gallant on and off for the past 20 months, no doubt irked at the fact that Gallant polls much better with the Israeli public than Bibi Netanyahu does. By all accounts, Yoav Gallant, a fellow member of Netanyahu's Likud party, has been an effective and respected leader in the war effort against the Palestinian terrorists of Hamas and Hezbollah, as well as the axis of evil states of Iran and Syria. Gallant has taken courageous and essential stands for including ultra-Orthodox young men in the army, pushing for the drafting of Haredim, who have abused the yeshiva exemption and left all the fighting to the rest of Israel's citizens. Netanyahu is afraid that if this becomes law, he will lose the political support in his coalition of the Haredi, the ultra-Orthodox parties, and have to call for a quick election, which he would lose. And so he fired Yoav Gallant. In March of 2023, a year and a half ago, Netanyahu also tried to fire Gallant because Gallant opposed gutting the judicial branch of the Israeli government for Netanyahu's personal benefit, believing it damaged Israel's security. But large, spontaneous Israeli public rallies in support of Gallant forced Bibi Netanyahu to change his mind and unfire him. This time, the fact that everyone was focused on the American election campaign and the wars meant that the protests could be more safely ignored, although Israeli protests there were, and large ones. Gallant has stated that Israel should be doing more to free the 101 remaining Israeli hostages still held by the Palestinian terrorists of Hamas in Gaza, some alive, some corpses ghoulishly held by these evil terrorists. There has been much criticism in Israeli society of Netanyahu for not prioritizing the negotiations that might have freed the remaining hostages. Yoav Gallant also has had an excellent working relationship with the U.S. Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, and is trusted by the American administration. Israel Katz, the current foreign minister, was quickly appointed by Netanyahu to replace Gallant. Although Katz was a paratrooper in the IDF and was an officer during his active service, Israel Katz has had no military experience beyond reserve duty since 1977. Looked it up nearly 50 years ago.
Oh, Danny boy, the pipes are calling from glen to glen and down the mountainside. The summer's gone and all the roses die. It's you must go, and I must buy.
School textbooks in Ireland foster anti-Semitic hatred, downplay the horrors of the Holocaust, and portray Israel as the problem in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, according to a newly released report. The Institute for Monitoring Peace and Cultural Tolerance in School Education, shorthand Impact SE, an education watchdog group, last week released a report entitled European Textbooks, Ireland Review. It revealed negative stereotypes and distortions of Israel, Judaism, and Jewish history. The findings were unveiled amid a surge in anti-Israel animus in Ireland and the promotion of anti-Semitic conspiracies by Irish government officials. Against this backdrop, Impact SE found that Irish textbook authors have stuffed their works with content likely to further fuel such a harsh and anti-Jewish environment. In one example, a history textbook for 11th graders describes Auschwitz, the infamous Nazi concentration camp in Poland, where at least a million Jews were murdered by the German Nazis during World War II. It describes Auschwitz as a prisoner of war camp, not an extermination, concentration camp, or death camp. Such a description minimizes the unique and horrific nature of the Holocaust and the systematic extermination of Jews carried out there. In other textbooks, including something called Inspire, Wisdom of the World, a religious studies book distributed to students as young as 12, Judaism is described as a war-mongering religion, which believes that violence and war are sometimes necessary to promote justice. Christianity and Islam, those peace-loving faiths, are more favorably judged as aiming for peace and justice. And in the case of Islam, resorting to war only in self-defense, to defend Islam but not to spread Islam and to protect people who are oppressed. That would be news to the many people oppressed by Islamists in Afghanistan, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Lebanon. And oh, by the way, how did Islam spread to 52 or 3 countries in the first place? Anyway, this same book in Ireland goes on to negate the charitable endeavors of Jewish civil society organizations to ease the plight of the marginalized and poor. It just omits them from a section discussing efforts by religions to combat homelessness. Quote, in this chapter, we're going to look at how some Christians and Muslims have responded to this issue by putting their faith into action. We're going to look at how some non-religious people and organizations respond to homelessness, just completely omitting Jewish efforts. Irish curricula is most aggressive, discussing Israel and the Palestinians, according to the new report. Citing this book, Inspire, again, the report revealed the textbook's authors chose to propagate the false claim that Jesus lived in quote-unquote Palestine, a piece of disinformation trafficked by anti-Zionists to diminish Jesus' Jewish heritage and deny the existence of a Jewish state in antiquity. Historical references to Jesus living in Palestine without appropriate context contribute to narratives challenging Israel's legitimacy, undermining the Jewish historical connection to the land, the report wrote. The text also says, in a comic strip, that some people did not like Jesus. The people shown in the comic strip are visibly Jewish, wearing kippot. This portrayal aligns with anti-Semitic stereotypes that blame Jews collectively for the death of Jesus, something the Catholic Church only let go of in 1964. Meanwhile, Impact SE noted that Inspire, this book, uses the New Testament parable of the Good Samaritan to accuse all Jews of lacking concern for non-Jews and of oppressing Palestinians for believing that God favors Jews above other groups. Wow. It frames the loss of territory that the Palestinians experienced not because of failed wars to destroy Israel and expel Jews, but because Jews keep taking their land. The report came out about a month after an Irish official, Dublin City Councillor Poonam Rain, claimed during a council meeting that Jews in Israel control the U.S. economy, arguing that's why Washington does not oppose Israel's war against the Palestinian terrorist murderers of Hamas. Ireland has been among the most vocal critics of Israel ever since October 7th of last year, when, of course, the Hamas-led Palestinian terrorists invaded the Jewish state from neighboring Gaza. They murdered 1,200 people, wounded thousands, abducted over 250 hostages. It was the deadliest single-day massacre of Jews since the Holocaust, of course. Israel responded with the ongoing military campaign against Hamas-ruled Gaza, aiming at freeing the hostages and destroying the terrorist group's military. In the months following the attack and the ensuing Israel-Hamas war, Ireland anti-Semitism has become blatant and obvious, according to Alan Shatter, former member of parliament who served in the Irish cabinet between 2011 and 2014 as Minister of Justice, Equality and Defense. Earlier this year, he said during an interview, Ireland has evolved into the most hostile state towards Israel in the entire EU. Still thinking about visiting Ireland next summer? Maybe vacation somewhere else, right? And Bernie Marcus, co-founder of Home Depot, his partner was Arthur Blank, both Jewish, of course. Bernie Marcus died last week. In addition to remaking the way we do our do-it-yourself work and creating a colossal business with 1,000 stores worldwide and, of course, being worth many billions of dollars, Bernie Marcus was a stalwart supporter of Israel. He founded, among other causes he funded, the Israel Democracy Institute in Jerusalem that strengthens the country's governance and democratic values. It's a nonpartisan think tank that was awarded the Israel Prize for its contribution to the State of Israel. Marcus's $25 million donation also helped establish Israel's National Blood Services Center, ensuring life-saving support for its citizens. May his memory be a blessing. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back the Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Linda Ambrose Brenneman, who discovered when she was 27 years old that her Catholic father was actually Jewish from Hungary, and that eventually in a house fire discovered an incredible treasure trove of family history that led back, well, I mean, to the Austrian Empire. Tell us a little bit about what the earliest, because the way the book is set up is really quite fascinating. It's a sort of a series of vignettes and then some longer biographies. Tell us how you decided to organize this, because, you know, this was a lot of material.
Well, what's interesting is, and what I had to do, I had to spend a lot of time researching and understanding history, because my history was not adequate at all. And I really wanted to understand, you know, what were the things that were going on during the times of their lives? Because I had the stories from my great-great uncle's book, but I didn't understand the history. And I decided to organize it sort of by generation and focus on the individual family member of that generation. So I started back in the 1700s with Isaac. And Isaac was the first one who became a Pulitzer, because back then, most Jews didn't have last names. They would go by their patronym. So he had been known as Isaac, son of Moses. And he was named Pulitzer because he came from the town of Politz, which today is in the Czech Republic. But what happened is, through some of the laws that the Austrian emperor of his time put in place, they wanted to tax Jews, actually, which is why they told them they had to get last names for tax control purposes. And often, and rather than allowing them to choose their names, mostly it was the town administrator or someone who gave them their name. And so he gave him the name of Isaac Pulitzer after the town he came from. It also happens to be the same town where Joseph Pulitzer, the publishing magnate, came from. And there's some evidence that they might have been cousins, but we didn't quite prove that, so I didn't cover that in the book.
What was the most surprising thing you discovered, particularly once you had someone to help you translate all of this? What was the most surprising thing you discovered in this archive?
You know, that's really a difficult question. There's so many surprises. I think overall, though, what was really amazing to me was these people who just suffered amazing, just cataclysmic events, and yet they always came out, when they always believed in education when it was very difficult at the time to educate their children. And sometimes they had to pay three times to send their children to a Catholic school, because there were only Catholic schools, there weren't any Jewish schools. But yet they worked hard, so hard, to give their children the best life possible. And they believed in education, and they also believed in service. Service was so important. So even though they had suffered these cataclysmic events, they always gave so generously to those who were in need, and tried to help them in amazing ways.
In exploring all of this, you had to wonder about the choice that your father made to essentially deny his Jewish background. How did that impact you?
I think when I first found out, I was angry about it. And I think it was subconscious, but I think, you know, it was more about the fact that he couldn't tell us the truth. But as I learned, and I'll go back to your previous question, I think one of the most shocking things I've learned was that my father actually served in a Nazi labor camp. And I had no idea, and I couldn't imagine my father serving in a Nazi labor camp. At the time, he was 20 years old. He was a medical student. He had been raised in privilege, so I don't think he had ever had to really...
No calluses on his hands when he got
dragged in. No calluses on his hands, unless he wanted them, you know?
Right.
So he had been raised in privilege, and then he was sent to a Nazi labor camp. And what we found out...
Do you know what year that was? Was that 1944? Was it earlier?
1944.
Yeah.
It was May of 1944 that he was conscripted. He left, and the day before he left, he proposed to my mother, who he had met in medical school. They were medical students and were dating. So I think it was shocking that he had gone to Nazi labor camp. And then the other shocking thing was the camp where he was had been bombed, and he and five other men escaped. And then when they escaped, they made their way back to Budapest, which is a complete surprise. They were actually captured two more times and somehow got away and somehow got clothes and food and money to get on a train and come back to Budapest, where they were hidden by my mother. But I have to tell you this one amazing story to me. This is just an incredible story that I found out much, much later on from the son of one of the men he escaped with. It turned out when they were on that train, they sat next to a Nazi soldier. And they were all fluent in German, so they struck up this conversation with him. And they had such a lively conversation that when the officer came in to check their tickets, he didn't. And that probably saved their butt, because I'm not sure they had tickets. But at any rate, when they arrived in Budapest and they got off the train, the Nazi soldier turned to them and said, "I wish every Hungarian was just like you." He had no idea that he was talking to five or six Jewish men who had just escaped from labor camp.
Wow. It's an amazing story. You know, the more survivors you talk to, the more stories that just, you know, it's the odds were so extraordinary that they managed to survive. It's crazy stuff.
Exactly.
You don't just talk about the Holocaust generation, of course, in the book. You go deep into history. Some of the people, you have a lot of information, some much less. Who do you wish you knew more about in your family's background?
Oh, my goodness. I want to say all of them. All of them.
Spoken as a historian, actually.
Yeah, it's just, you know, and I think that's why I had to write the book. I had to write the book because I wanted to be connected to them. And as I wrote, I just fell in love with all of them. I really did. I would have loved to have learned more about different periods of their time, like Sigmund Pulitzer, who wrote Our Family History. He never wrote beyond about himself.
Right.
Beyond, you know, maybe his mid-20s. And I wish I would have learned more about him. He was an incredible entrepreneur and invested in automobiles when they were just coming out, and railroads and so on and so forth. So I would have loved to learn about him. I would have loved to learn about my own great-great-grandfather, who married my great-grandmother, Jula Pulitzer. My father is actually named after him. And I actually have some of his high school and grade school report cards and some of the letters that he wrote to students. And one of the letters, they moved from a small town about an hour south of Budapest to Budapest. And then when he, and so he only had a year in this new school. And when he graduated, there's this letter that he wrote that said, "Oh, we're all going to get together in, you know, I think it was 20 years or something." So for him to make such good friends, sounded like he had such a great sense of humor. And for him to make such close friends, even after being at this school for just 1 year, I find that remarkable. And of course, you know, historical events changed their ability to get together.
Well, of course. Yeah. So it took you a long time to write this book, or at least to come out with it, more than three decades. Tell us about that delay.
Well, it took me three decades to actually decide to explore my family's history. So I first learned that my father was Jewish when I was 27, and I didn't start on this exploration until I was about 60. So that's the decades, and I think it's because, you know, life just got in the way. When I first found out I was in business school, I was trying to figure out what my career was. And, you know, then later on I met my husband. And so life just got in the way. But there was always this nagging feeling. I've got to, you know, learn who my father was, who my ancestors were, and really who I was. Yeah. So it was time, finally, when I was 60.
In creating this book, you've brought together a remarkable history, Hungarian Jewish history. There's been a big display about it. Tell us about that.
You're talking about the synagogue.
Yeah, in Budapest.
Yes. Yeah, so what happened was when I was researching, and, you know, I had Andras Kaczynski was my fellow researcher. When he would try to find things out, he used the Hungarian Jewish Museum and Archives. He went there often to try to find information and he worked closely with some of the people there. And so as they started to learn some of these stories, it just coincided with the time that they had decided to renovate the Rumbach Synagogue, which is just stunningly beautiful from an architectural perspective. It's very unique and gorgeous, gorgeous synagogue. And it hadn't been renovated since World War II, so it was in terrible shape. And what they decided to do is upstairs, they wanted to create a permanent exhibit to try to inspire Hungarians to learn about their roots. Because many Hungarians, you know, after the Holocaust, the communists took over. And I hate to say it, but the communists were just as anti-Semitic as the Nazis were.
Oh, no doubt. Yeah.
And very, you know, they lived under really horrible circumstances. So most Jewish families hid their roots. Of the survivors, I mean, there were so many, you know, there had been 600,000 Jews in Budapest before the Holocaust. And, you know, there maybe were 100,000 afterwards. So families had been wiped out, but those that had survived, you know, they hid their roots. And so it was time for Hungarians now to learn about their roots. And they wanted this exhibit to inspire others to do the same. So it's a beautiful exhibit. It consists of 10 films, and each film is based on the stories in the book.
It's great. What a wonderful tribute. I want to thank Linda Ambrose Brenneman for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The book is called The Pulitzer Saga, not Pulitzer, but Pulitzer, The Pulitzer Saga. Where can people go to find out more about the book, to find out more about you?
They can. I have a website, PulitzerSaga.com, and there's lots of information there. And then I have a Facebook page, Linda Brenneman Author, and Instagram, Linda Brenneman Author. And they can buy the book on Amazon or Barnes & Noble.
Thank you so much, Linda.
Thank you, Rabbi Cohn.
My pleasure. Our pleasure. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Cohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be the illustrious writer Tova Reich, National Jewish Book Award winner and author of Camp Jeff. Join us, Congregation Beit Simcha, each Friday night. Services in Onig Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading in Kiddush in person and on our Facebook page. Our playout this morning comes from Eden Golan. I think it's time again to play the original version of Israel's Eurovision song titled Hurricane, written in the aftermath of October 7th, 2023. Originally, it was called October Rain.
We remember the 101 Israelis still held in the hell of Gaza after 13 months of captivity. My friends, have a Shavuot Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of justice and peace.
Writers of the history, stand with me. Look into my eyes and see. People go away but never say goodbye. Someone stole the moon tonight, took my light. Everything is black and white. Who's the fool who told?
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.